You want to go there in your Bible tonight? And before we jump into that, I want to say a word to you about our special event that's coming up in November. Is it 5, 6, and 7, right?
Sure, yes.
5, 6, and 7?
5, 6, 7.
You need to be more confident about that.
This is your job. You're the calendar guy.
Yeah, I am the calendar guy. That's right. 5, 6, and 7. That should be a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. If it's not, we're wrong about the
whatever dates. The first Friday, Saturday, Sunday is.
Yes, and so that's going to be our special event for this fall. But it's really going to be a different kind of event. On Friday night, it's going to look like traditional gospel meeting with some singing first, and then Brother Don Truex is going to speak to us. But on Saturday, we're going to have a series of classes at 10, at 11, and at 2 o'clock. And so at each of those sessions, you'll have the option of three different classes to choose from. And what that'll do is it'll break us up into smaller groups, let you pick a topic, really narrow down to the thing you think you need most, and also to have some interaction with the teacher. And so Brother Truex will be here doing some with that. David McClister is going to be here helping us some with that. Some of our guys will be involved in that. There's actually announcements and a schedule out in the foyer. And then on Sunday, David McClister will speak to us, and that'll wrap up our event. But here's the important thing. We need you to do something. We need you to sign up for classes. Now, one of the classes will be in the auditorium. Don't sweat it. If you're going to be in there, plenty of room, right? We don't need your name on a list. Would be nice if we could kind of sit together. That'd make it easier for whoever's teaching in here. But for the two classes that'll be going on the back, if you'd like to go back to one of those, we need you to sign up, because we can't put 80 people in one of those rooms. And so there's 30 names on the list, and when it's full, it's full. I'm sorry. We'll try to get those recorded or something if it's too full and you don't get to go in. But that's an incentive to sign up early so that you can get the classes that you want. So that's in the back. Sign-up sheets are in the back. Flyers in the back. Tell folks about it. Love to have others come. But first and foremost, for our folks, that's what we're going to be doing first weekend in November. Did I miss anything?
I think that's it.
You good with that?
I am.
Okay, so we're in the song tonight. We're working at chapter 5. That means we're just on the other side of the divide.
The divide being the wedding night.
The wedding, yeah, the wedding night. Yep. Jeff and I have been saying from the beginning of that both of us sort of see that as a dividing point in the book. That prior to that, we watched the couple fall in love, and after that,
they have to maintain love.
That's a very nice way to put that. What happens after that?
Life.
Well, that's actually, you know, if it is a book about romantic love and sexual intimacy, then I think some would assume there isn't much to say after chapter 4.
Well, see, and to that point, David, the way, you know, the modern culture does this, you know, think about your romantic movies, your Disney movies, as I like to beat up on Disney movies. You know, everything always culminates in the wedding, and they lived happily ever after. And that's where the story always stops, whether it's, you know, you took your wife or your girlfriend to a chick flick, as we sometimes derogatively call them, a romantic comedy of some sort, a Disney movie. It always ends with the wedding, and they run off into the sunset. And the problem is nobody makes movies, or at least rarely makes movies, about real life for the next 50 years. And how you actually do love and marriage over the long haul, not just in the ecstasies of early infatuation and strongly erotic attraction.
And I think that a lot of folks, because of real life experience, assume that what happens to romantic love after the honeymoon is that maybe it kind of continues on for a while.
Yeah.
But then over time, it just begins to die a slow death.
Oh, sure. Well, and think about how many comedic routines we've seen, yeah, or even jokes are made about that very idea.
And so you end up, after 30, 40 years of marriage, just being roommates who share the bills rather than two people who share a passionate love affair, like we read in the first half of the book, right?
Right.
And in fact, I think that's what inspires some people when they get to middle age, they've been married 20 or 30 years, to Well, to have an affair.
Right.
Because I want to reignite the spark.
I want chapters 1 through 4 rather than learning how to do 5 through 8.
Right. Or to divorce and marry somebody else, because right. I think the answer is to start over again.
Because living in lust is easier than living in love.
So one of the things we should probably be crystal clear about before we go forward is that isn't God's plan. And if you've been married 30 years and it's kind of ended up there, that isn't what God had in mind for us. I think back to Proverbs 5. If I could go away from the song just for a minute. Because in Proverbs 5, verse 18, Solomon says, "Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth." Rejoice with the one you married when you were young. Right. It doesn't mean they're still young.
Right.
But that's the one you need to be with.
Right.
And he talks about, in verse 19, being exhilarated always with her love. "For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner?"
Right. And almost what you see in that, David, is the idea that love and marriage done biblically and correctly can actually almost get better with time is almost kind of the idea. You know, the youthful passions are just, kind of the down payment, or at least what gets you going and gets you interested in marriage and that in the first place. But love can age well instead of aging badly, as our culture kind of views it.
And there is a certain logic to that, isn't there? Mm-hmm. You would think the two people who spent a lifetime being in love with each other, sharing a romance with each other, and let's be plain, the kids have gone to class, making love to each other, over life, coming to know each other better, that ought to be something that grows and matures, not something that dwindles and dies. And the fact that lovemaking is part of this, folks, notice, I skipped over this a moment in verse 19, but he talks about, "Let her breast satisfy you with all times." In chapter 5, he's talking about romantic love. He's talking about sexual love.
Right.
And how that needs to be a source of joy and pleasure throughout life, not just at the beginning.
And to tag on to that, most or a lot of modern English translations have moved away from the literal Hebrew translation of the sexual relationship in the Old Testament, which is, and the man knew his wife. And so, the more I think about it, that really is, a very intentional, God-intended word for it, where it's not just about the erotic satisfactions. All of this works together to create an ever-deepening knowledge of each other physically, sure, but knowledge of the person, because sex was meant to be unitive between the man and the woman. Obviously, it's unitive literally, and it produces a child that is one flesh out of the two of them, literally. But it's meant to bond, it's meant to unite, it's meant to create an ever-deepening knowledge of each other. And when you see it that way, or use that as your frame of reference, you begin to realize, the longer we do this together and are together, the more the knowledge can deepen, which is why, again, over time, it ought to get better and even more powerfully unitive.
I think that the poems we're going to see through the rest of the book illustrate how that is done.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Not just that God intended that there would be ongoing passionate love affair between the two people, but that it would even be victorious over the problems and the challenges and the passing of time, that's actually what God intended. And tucked within the poetry, I even think, are some clues about how that's pulled off. And so that's what we're going to be working on tonight, starting in chapter 5, where after this great love story that we've enjoyed up to now, the poems about these two people falling in love, and even with all their joy and their fears and all of that coming together and on the wedding night, when we get into chapter 5 for the first time, things are not good between them. And that's stunning, that two people would fall in love and get married and then have a problem.
That's real life, though. I think that, again, Disney cuts us off before we got to this part of the story.
You are down on Disney tonight. What is that? Did you sell your stock or what?
that's right. They got rid of some rides I liked. But our culture lies to us about this. That real life with a real person. If you look at marriage as a school towards holiness, towards learning to love, more deeply, more selflessly, It's, I don't know what you do, you know, when you're talking to get couples in premarital counseling. One of the things I talk to them about is, you know, sometimes why it's a little bit challenging at the beginning is you're putting two rocks together that don't fit together very well until they rub a little bit. And over time, you know, they fit together better. So this is their first fight. If, I mean, you know, it's not exactly, but you know what I mean.
Well, let's take a look at the poem. We're going to begin in 5, and let's read a little bit of this. We're beginning at 5 and 2 because Jeff and I actually agree that perhaps one of the most terrible chapter breaks ever in the Bible occurs here at the end of chapter 4. Because clearly chapter 5, verse 1, you agree with me about this,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
5:1 goes with that last section, and we even studied it with that last section. So we're picking up at 5:2. Let me just read a little bit of this. And as I read, notice the slide behind me. Remember the three questions. What do you see? That's what we want you to think about right now, and then we'll come back to, well, what does it mean and what do we learn from it? But right now, just think about what we're seeing. I actually think this is one of the easier segments to talk about that.
In this section, yeah.
Yeah. 5:2. This is the bride speaking, the wife now. And remember, if you didn't get a copy of the text with the parts broken out, those are in the back. You can get those. So this is 5:2. I was asleep, but my heart was awake. A voice, my beloved, was knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is drenched with dew. My locks are my locks damp with the night. I have taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I dirty them again? My beloved extended his hands through the opening, and my feelings were aroused for him. I rose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, and my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved turned away and had gone. My heart went out to him as he spoke. I searched for him, but I did not find him. I called to him, but he did not answer me. Let's pause right there and just think about what's going on. Notice where we begin in verse 2. Does that sound familiar to you guys? We encountered that before. So make you think back to chapter 3, where we kind of had that dream sequence right before the wedding, and she's worried about losing him. And so we have a similar kind of thing here. In fact, this almost sounds like a short story, doesn't it?
Well, it does. You know, it's a dream or a nightmare, perhaps. And, you know, like chapter 3, you know, where she's worried about losing him, here, at least in this dreamlike state where I slept but my heart was awake, she does lose him, at least for the moment, or at least seems to, depending on how we want to do some of these following verses.
Well, he goes away.
Right.
So he goes away right by the time we get to the end of it.
There's a disconnect.
But what is it that transpires? Evidently, the way that she describes it in her dream, he has come to her to see her. And I think the indication is he is interested in sexual intimacy.
Correct.
Which, remember, before the wedding.
Right.
Eager for that, right? In fact, they had to put boundaries around those passions. And so now he is back to see her again.
Right.
Now that they are married and he's put off.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely.
I'm watching to see how much trouble I'm going to get in when we go down this road. I'm waiting for the questions to come in. he seems to be interested in sexual intimacy. And I really thought today about how to say this. This is not a good time for her. Fair enough?
Yeah, for whatever reason.
Inconvenient.
Inconvenient. You know, the typical excuses. You know, I can't.
I did not say that. That Jeff said that. Y'all heard that, right?
I'm going under the bus tonight.
Yes, yeah. Every opportunity. But she declines. And yet the interesting thing is almost immediately regrets it, right? Do you see that?
Yeah.
And tries to reach back out to him, but in the dream he's already gone. And then this does sound a lot like 3, right?
Yeah.
She's going back out looking for him, which
Correct.
Is what we saw in 3.
Correct. But this time it's different. In both sections, in 3 and in 5, she encounters the watchmen as she goes about. The first time they're just kind of mute, don't really.
Don't get to the watchmen yet.
You don't want to go to the watchmen
Let's
yet.
Save that. Let's because we got to talk about.
What do you want to talk about then?
We got to talk about what's going on here.
Okay.
And what's happened between the two of them? So what's happened? They've had a problem.
Yeah, she said no.
which is well. It's so it appears that what's going on is that their desires have not quite lined up.
Well, sure.
On this occasion.
Yeah, which, you know, just as a sidebar, in marriage, I mean, a lot of conflict comes from just unmet expectations that maybe weren't, either they weren't clearly communicated or whatever. I mean, this could certainly happen sexually. A lot of sexual frustration in marriage among married couples is about different expectations about how the sexual relationship will work, not to be crass, but how often, and so, you know, just expectations. And almost always someone is more frisky, I don't know what the right word is, and interested, and others aren't. Don't look at me, don't look to them for support. Don't do that.
We want to... Kendrick, we want to hang on to that recording right there.
Your meme for tonight, my
friend.
Save
that one.
Yeah. But a lot of other spheres of life in general, you know, a lot of marital conflict comes from unmet expectations. Somebody was expecting something, and somebody didn't realize it or didn't put a priority on it.
What are the things, as I reflected back on this, that is striking to me is how this is such a different tone from everything we've seen up to now, that they've just fallen in love, just want to be with each other, and they're really careful to take care of each other.
Well, an insatiable desire. They're bull just singing about the desire, and then all of a sudden, where's the desire?
Yes, and so there is that rather sharp contrast to the way things have been before. And I don't think you should, though I think this is the topic here, it's the issue of sexual intimacy, it isn't limited to that.
Right.
Because lot of times, you know what I tell kids in Bible class about dating? We have a label for it. We call it the big lie, okay? and the reason we call it the big lie is because guys just don't behave that way that well all the time, right? We're on our best behavior when we're dating because we're convincing her, right? She is the right one. And we're not always that careful about fixing up, not like when we're dating somebody. And so when you get into married life, that's real life. It isn't the kind of put-on life.
Best foot forward.
Of dating. Yeah, right. That's exactly right. And so here, some of those realities begin to set in, and things begin to be a little different. They got a rift between them now. And so I think that exposes some realities of what married life is like, that our desires don't always line up. And that isn't just about sex.
Right.
That with regard to lots of things in marriage, sometimes... Right. Our desires don't always line up with each other. For example, in the use of resources.
Right.
How are we going to spend the money? Didn't Bubba talked about that at some point this weekend? Was it today?
Yesterday.
He talked about how husbands and wives can have different ideas about how the money is spent, right? Mm-hmm. We can have different ideas about how to do the schedule. So the holidays are coming up. Where are you going for Thanksgiving? Well, when you've been married almost 36 years like Heidi and I, we've addressed the issue of how we work out families. But for newly married couples, did y'all struggle with that early on? What? We're not going to my family's house for Christmas? What do you mean? I'm always with my family. So schedules don't always line up. And so these points of friction begin to emerge.
Well, and to go a step further with that, too, going back to the concept of the big lie, not only is it the whole we drop the facade, so to speak, when we get married sometimes, because you really don't live, you know, dressed to the nines with cologne and properly cleaned and shaven all the time. The other part of it is, in our culture, we think if you found the right person, you should never have a disagreement. You know, if you've married your true soulmate, then there's never going to be any of these conflicts or these differences. You're always going to see eye to eye. After all, when you were dating, you liked the same kinds of movies and liked to go to the same kinds of restaurants and rooted for the same teams, right? And so this almost, again, why the Disney movie stops where it does this superficial, simplistic idea that there's not going to be any differences between us that might become foxes in the vineyard.
Yep. So those of us who've been married for a while understand that, right? That there is... this coming together, there is this blending of lives that inevitably has its points of frictions with it. As a side about our kids, that needs to be part of our training. We're bringing up our kids to explain that piece of married life, that there will be those points of friction. But here's a danger. When that begins to emerge, what does it do to romantic love? Right?
Right. It douses it.
That's exactly right. Those periods of conflict can begin to douse romantic love. There is this myth, and I think it's been started by guys, this idea about makeup sex, that when you've had a conflict, well, you fix it by being romantically intimate with each other. I say God must have made that up, because that is not the way women are wired that way. There's an emotional dimension to that. It just doesn't allow that to be, I think, as meaningful until that's really resolved. It's hard to be romantic and intimate when you've still got bitterness stored up in your heart over marital conflicts. And so you think about when those points of friction emerge, especially if they don't get resolved and solved, what does that do
right
to romantic love? It begins to wear it away and destroy it.
Well, it becomes, in this dream, the door closed between the two.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. Go back to those dimensions of romantic love we talked about earlier?
The four C's.
Yeah, when we were going through chapter 1 and 2, especially, we watched the interplay between this couple that's falling in love, and we noticed some of the things they were doing. They were spending time together, right? So what happens when we stop doing that? We're married now, careers are pursued, the kids come along, investment has to be made in that. What happens when we stop dating? And then what happens when there isn't that loving communication? You remember that back and forth between them all the time? He would tell her what a beautiful flower she was, and he was the apple tree in the forest, right? All that kind of stuff. That sappy, lovey stuff going on between them, right? There was that loving communication. Well, what happens when that isn't happening? In fact, what happens when it's replaced with bitter words, right?
Right.
And then instead of taking care of each other, like we see him taking care of her when she's sensitive about her tan skin, what happens when we begin to act selfishly? Everything is driven, like during the holidays. I want to be with my family. How can I manipulate my spouse to get my way about that? What happens when that begins to happen? When companionship and communication and caring stop, guess what else goes away? That craving for physical intimacy with each other.
Right.
Which is, by the way, when people say, maybe get 10 years into marriage and they say, I'm just not in love with him anymore. Or I just haven't felt love for her in years. What do people mean when they say that? You ever thought about that? Because I'm always tempted, when a guy says that to me, I just don't think I'm in love with my wife anymore, I'm tempted to say, well, you better cut that out. Because that's a sin. We're commanded to love our spouse. But that's just being funny. I think that misses the point. What does he mean when he says that? He says, I don't feel those powerful feelings of passion
right.
and desire anymore. And where did that go?
Well, it died with the C's.
It died with the communication and the caring and the companionship.
Right, right.
So do you see, folks, it's not a mystery. Did my mic die? So Kendricks, I saw that this looked like it had a dead battery, and I should have said something about it. So what I'm going to say is, Bubba wore this mic this morning and talked so long, he just literally took all the juice out of it.
You know, the clicker doesn't work for you either. I'm just saying.
It is like the technology at this church hates me. You're actually bringing me a whole new mic? That is amazing. We have the best tech guys in the world here. No matter what Jeff says.
I live under the bus, man. Hostile work environment, I'm telling you.
How about that? Sorry about that. Thank you, Charles. Charles came in and was staring at me in the back, and I'm like, what did I do? I don't know. What did I do?
Yeah, this is the Song of Songs. We get in trouble a lot of ways here tonight.
I think that's right. So it's interesting. I've taught, I don't know, 4 or 5 classes on the Song of Solomon, but I never get more trouble than when I teach chapter 5. Can y'all see that train wreck coming? Because when I get chapter 5 and I talk about, you know, the fact that he is interested in being intimate and she turns him down, the ladies in my class erupt.
Well, and stop right there, because what we want to do in these kind of moments is assign blame in this to either him or her.
Well, and so, yeah. And so it's like, wait a minute, Banning. And when they call me by my last name, I know I'm in trouble. He should have been more sensitive to her timing here. I wasn't arguing with that. But then the guys in the class take over, and they push back. She didn't want to get her feet wet. Come on. Where was all that passion for him that we see back in chapter 2? Do y'all see what's going on there? Why people would respond that way? I think because we read the story selfishly.
Well, we read the story the same way we do marital conflict, which is I look at the other person's responsibility rather than my own.
That, and I think that's exactly what folks are doing. I'm seeing it through my eyes as the way I would want it or the way I would see it if I were in that situation. And literally, it's though I'm defending my own position when I do that. So it's a real interesting dynamic to watch that sort of go on in class, because I think it's one exposes one of the reasons that we really struggle with our marital conflicts, and that is because we process them selfishly. Well, that was sort of tart, wasn't it? I think we need to be straight up about that. We process them selfishly. When in reality, if we're going to fix them, who do we need to be looking at? Y'all could say something. Yeah. I need to be looking at myself and my part in this. And a guy reads this, he does need to see maybe where the guy's messing up here. A lady reads this, she needs to see maybe where the lady's going wrong. I need to look at it from the angle of what would be my part. And by the way, I'll tell you, and I found in the one or two fights that my wife and I have had in 36 years of marriage, I expected more laughter when I said that.
She's not smiling. No,
she knows better. She knows better. I have found that when I am careful to point out all of my wife's fault in our argument, that doesn't go very well. Have y'all found that too? And on those few occasions when wisdom just blew through the room and hit me the right way for some reason, when I've had the wisdom start out by saying, here's what I think I'm doing that's messing this up, how do y'all think that goes? It's amazing how my wife will fall on her sword and acknowledge her fault and say, no, I really think, you know, it's about... y'all think I'd be a little better at this, having picked up on that. I'm not. But if we could take that unselfish approach and process it through our part and what I need to do, I think that would be the beginning of fixing stuff like this.
Well, it's the human nature. I think about the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector, and one justified himself to God. That's just what we do, period, with ourselves, is we rationalize where we're at and find ways to assign blame to someone else for whatever's wrong.
And so they have a problem. And I'm really glad that this is part of the poems, because it is part of the struggle for everyone in marriage. So since you have such an affinity for the Watchmen, why don't you grab 7, 8, and 9? Because we didn't really finish how this works out. Let's read 7, 8, and 9. And talk a little bit about this next segment, which I think is really important.
Yeah, my reading, you read.
You go ahead. Right. I'll let you read this. You like The Watchmen anyway, so.
The Watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me. They bruised me. They took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am sick with love. What is your beloved more than another man? Than another beloved, O most beautiful among women. What is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us?
So how many of y'all, when you read that, just think, I don't have a clue what that's talking about. How utterly bizarre is it? It is just the strangest thing, especially verse 7. She goes out looking for a guy, and she's talking to a cop who beats her up. What does that have to do with this? And how strange is all of that? So you have, as she begins this search again, which takes us back to 3, right?
Yeah, that's right.
This is almost a repeat parallels of the dream. Yeah.
With an important twist.
Yeah, yeah. So she encounters the watchman, who basically did nothing last time.
In chapter 3, that's right.
And boy, it doesn't seem like they ever do the right thing. This time they beat her up.
Right.
And then you get to the daughters of Jerusalem, and she goes to them and she says, help me find my guy. I'm lovesick for him. And then they ask a question. Now, pay attention to the daughters of Jerusalem on the back half of this and their questions, because I think they kind of help frame up the reconciliation.
That's right. They're the key to the solution to all this, as much as we've been talking about other stuff. They're the poem's answer to what's going on.
Right. So in 9, there's a question. Mm-hmm. And then when we get to this again in a couple of weeks, on the 31st, we're going to come back to the song.
6-1.
It's 6-1. There's a second question that sort of frame up the ending of this. So you're getting a prelude to what's coming. So
in other words, what we're doing right now is going to span over 2 weeks, because the daughters of Jerusalem are going to do 2 things to help her.
This is going to be a long fight.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Reconciliation.
So let's talk first about these watchmen, because is there anything more strange than that? That just seems to be totally out of place
right,
in this poem.
Right. Okay. You know, but going back to this dream or sequence or whatever's going on with her, you know, it's nighttime. She finally opens the door, but he's gone. So she goes looking for him. The desire's been re-aroused. She's looking for him. And she goes out in the city, which in the ancient world, you just didn't do as a woman at night, right? I mean, it's kind of dangerous to walk around downtown Houston alone these days. In the ancient world, no street lights, no cameras to catch the perpetrator, no CSI. It was dangerous. Watchmen, of course, patrolled. But watchmen were the enforcers of order and things being right. And so, in a sense, she's going to encounter 2 people as she goes out, or 2 groups, the watchmen and the daughters of Jerusalem. The watchmen, to your point, they do nothing in chapter 3, but that was before she was married. Now she's married. And so there's an obligation in the sense. And so perhaps as the guard, you know, one possible interpretation, qualify this, because this is poetry, you know, you can wiggle with this a little bit. But one possible way of looking at this, as much as we've talked about don't assign blame, but the poem might, at least in this instance, be shoving or putting its thumb on the scale one way or the other between what the daughters of Jerusalem say and what the watchmen do, which is as the guardians of law and order, if you will. They rough her up. They take her veil away. Essentially, they're telling her to go home. They're making it dangerous for her to be out there, and she needs to go home. She needs to go back then, which is what she's trying to do. But there, she has obligations now. In chapter 3, she didn't. She wasn't married yet. Now she does, and they're kind of enforcing the there's a right place for you to be. It's with your husband. It's at home. It's in bed at night. You know, the married people's place. And so that this may be a way of kind of implying that she needs to get back to where she needs to be, rather than being out about at night. And then the daughters of Jerusalem are going to ask some actual helpful questions to clarify to her what she needs to do in her head and her heart to literally get back to where she needs to be in this marriage.
So the watchman may serve as a symbol.
Correct.
For the things in our life that in a crisis like this would push us to do the right thing.
Hold us accountable.
Push us to do the right thing. Can you think about who that might include? Like maybe there would be some people in our life who, when we were maybe struggling or headed in the wrong direction, would push us in the right direction. Or maybe you might think about some teaching that's in the Word of God that when we're struggling would nudge us and put... or. That's not even, let's be blunt. That would shout at us and push us back in the way that we ought to go. I really think that that is an interesting way to see the role of the watchman.
Right. Here. They are the ones who know what right order and the right way of doing things is. And she's out of order. And so she's being encouraged. I know you're smiling already. But being encouraged to do what she needs to do, take responsibility for herself.
I just think that look, I buy what Jeff is saying about that. because I think if you want to start to get in some lessons for us, I think there are those same kind of voices,
right,
that when we're not who we ought to be, what we ought to be in our marriages, who push us,
right,
to shape up.
And they do it in ways that at the time feel painful, just like the watchman's work on her roughs her up.
So before we get to that, yeah, as a contrast to that, that isn't what culture is going to tell you when you're in a rough place in your marriage, right? I know that some folks have struggled greatly, and they'll have a coworker who will say, look, you're not happy.
Right. You have a right to be happy.
Dump the guy.
Right.
And go find someone else. And I've seen some of my own brothers and sisters who knew better, but who took that counsel, went against what they knew the Bible said, and divorced their spouse.
Right.
And so there are voices out there who won't do what the watchmen do, who will encourage us in the wrong path. And yet, can you think of voices in your life, if you had a fallen out with your spouse and you were walking away, who would slap you around about that? You got some people like that in your life? I don't mean physically. You knew that, right? Y'all shake your heads. You don't need that. But have you ever got talked to in a way that made you feel like you got slapped around a little bit? Has anybody ever just kind of talked straight to you and stood you up about some place where you maybe early in your marriage, ladies, you were kind of at odds with your husband and you went home expecting your mom to be sympathetic, and she said something like, you need to get back home to your husband and patch this up. You don't need to be here talking to me about him. Or maybe guys got a good stern talking to from your dad. Listen, you shouldn't be treating your wife that way. You need to do it better. Go home and apologize to her. How'd that feel? Maybe like you got slapped around a little bit, right? And I think that's a great figure. What do we do with those voices in our life that work hard on us sometime when we need that?
And speak to us in the way that hurts, and we need to remember, you know, faithful are the wounds of a friend.
I thought about that. Proverbs says 27:6.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Faithful are the wounds of a friend. I think that's a great passage,
right,
to drop in here, that we need people in our lives who will play the role of the watchman, holding us accountable to God and to his standard, and will give us that push, that nudge we need. I think it's really sad sometimes that those are the people that we villainize.
Well, sure, and then we'd start to blame them, actually get mad at them, or even cut them off and won't listen to them because, you know, they don't really understand, or they're not a real friend now, or whatever it is.
And the really sad thing about that is you know how that's going to shake out, right?
Oh, sure.
You know, you can kind of see how that's going to go in the long term. Listen, folks, when we get off the path and we're not doing what God wants us to do, it never works out well. It's never going to a good place. And so those are voices that we need to hear, even when it feels like we're taking a beating, right? Ever feel that way? Someone's talking straight up to you, and man, it just feels like you took a beating, like they were really hard on you. And maybe at the moment, that's exactly what I needed. And so the watchmen are sending her back home. Somebody asked about taking away her veil.
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, we're dealing with a dream. You're dealing with symbolism here. I think the idea is, you know, a veil was an item of a woman's modesty in that culture, right? It was a covering. And so I think the idea was to just strip away, perhaps, again, all that she's using to protect and hide herself as she goes through the night there. And their way of just kind of laying her bare. And again, going back to the whole, you need to go home with your husband and be, you know, don't cover yourself up and hide, if you will, from all of this. You know, the veil is the woman's modesty. It keeps people from seeing what ought not be seen. She's covering herself up and going around. She needs to take it off and go home. And so in a sense, what they're actually doing, it's almost like it's almost like an intervention. It's a way of saying, you can't go on doing this. By taking her veil away, she has, she goes around like a prostitute now, or she goes home.
I think that you guys will be able to press us on the imagery. When you're dealing with poetry, that's always the question, right? I read Revelation, and some of the commentators have a theory on every little single detail in that book. And sometimes I wonder if the Holy Spirit knew he put all that stuff in the book. And so I don't know sometimes how much to read into the detail and how much to see it as just part of a broader picture. That's the nature of wrestling with the poetry, okay? So wrestle away. Those are the kind of questions we have to deal with. We need to comment on the daughters of Jerusalem, because now they're going to come into the picture. And she's seeking their help, too.
Yeah, which is kind of ironic, since she's giving them advice earlier in the book, and now they're the voice of wisdom actually giving her what she needs to hear.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes they seem to play a helpful role, and sometimes they seem to be irritating to her. but hey, when you need help, so she's seeking them out. But the curious thing is, she wants them to carry a message to him,
right,
for her, and their response is to ask a question of her.
Right.
So, and it seems to be this. So what's so special about this guy?
Right.
Why are you so concerned about this problem with him? What's so special that you would want us to do this for you? And there seems to be an agenda behind that question.
Well, sure. I mean, absolutely. It's the opportunity. You know, it's a fantastic question, because it forces her, you know, that maybe that desire is coming back a little bit, to really focus on why she married him in the first place, so to speak. What do you like, you know, rather than why you were irritated or all the, you know, we were given the reasons she didn't want to let him in at the beginning. Now they're inviting him to go the opposite, you know, the daughters of Jerusalem are inviting her to go the opposite way and think about why she wants him in the first place. And when you focus on the elements that create desire, rather than the things that diminish desire, well, then you're where you need to go.
So before we get married, we develop a list, right?
Oh, all the when our parents want to know why him or why her, we you know, you have that talk and you're able to explain yourself to your family.
So when people fall in love, they can think about all of the qualities that make them fall in love with a person. Right?
Right.
And so actually, if we went back to chapters 1, 2, and 3, we could probably put together a list of all the things that they loved about each other. And I think when couples are dating, that they do the same thing. They develop this list of everything I love about her, everything I love about him. Sometimes not very good lists.
Right.
Because they are one-sided, right?
Shallow or self-oriented.
Maybe some of you had a daughter who was dating a boy who was a loser. And she couldn't see it, right? She could give you a list of all the, I was doing this with a teenage girl one time. She was dating a boy that, frankly, folks, was a class A loser. I mean, he was right up there at the top of losers. I knew this because I'd been on his Facebook page. I'm pretty sure he was a drug dealer, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that. I mean, he was not a very high-level human being. And as she began explaining what was good about him, and I was astonished. I asked her, I said, have you been on his Facebook page and seen what he wrote? And boy, she had a way of justifying every flaw. I said, did you notice this post? Did you see that language that he used? He's openly promoting his use of marijuana. Well, he promised me he's going to stop that whenever we get married.
I can change him.
Yes, yes. So we develop a list, and it isn't always a very realistic list when we're dating, which, by the way, thinking about the kids, because we're thinking about them all the way through this. Helping them know how to really properly evaluate somebody and make an accurate list is important. But after we get married, we make a list too, don't we?
That's the opposite one.
Why?
Because now we're looking for advantage and control and getting our own selfish way and justifying ourselves. And so their faults and their flaws become justification for why we're right, we're a martyr, we're a good person putting up with this, or eventually even just get leverage over them to get what we want.
Yeah, somehow after marriage, the focus shifts from the positive qualities that made us fall in love with a person to the negative qualities that
everything's an irritant now
result from frictions. And what's what I find fascinating is how often they're interrelated. You know, during dating, she says, "Oh, it's so great. He just takes care of everything." After marriage, he is so controlling. He just plans everything, right? So obviously, a lot of times the things we loved are then the things we complain about, the negative side of what could be positive qualities. But we develop that other list. And when things get bad enough, we can recite it to other people, right?
Well, in fact, it's what we do. We go to our own daughters of Jerusalem with the opposite list.
And recite the list. Yeah. What do you think that does to romantic love when we create that list? If I am convinced that I am living with a scoundrel, what does it do to romantic love? Just destroys it,
sure.
Right? And that's what I think is interesting about what the daughters of Jerusalem here do. It's as though they challenge her, tell us about this guy that you fell in love with.
Right.
And we get her renewed list, her fresh look at him.
Well, and ironically, we get her post-marital list because this is a little bit racier than previous descriptions as well. That's the irony is she's actually using their marital experience as far to ironically actually deepen it, which, you know, maybe get a little bit ahead of us, but the bell's going to catch us anyways. You know, marital conflicts can actually lead to stronger marriages when they're done rightly, because this is actually a better list than what she's given us before in the book whenever she's given her youthful schoolgirl gushing over what a great guy he is.
We should read this.
Okay.
Verse 10, "My beloved is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is like gold, pure gold. His locks are like clusters of dates, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk and reposed in their setting. His cheeks are like a bed of balsam, banks of sweet-scented herbs. His lips are lilies dripping with liquid myrrh. His hands are rods of gold set in beryl. His abdomen is carved ivory inlaid with sapphires. His legs are pillars of alabaster set on pedestals of pure gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is full of sweetness. He is wholly desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." I think that the question intended to drive her back to that picture.
Right.
And to think about his good qualities again.
Mm-hmm. And it's even deeper again and more vivid than it was before. She's actually growing in her ability to assess and thus desire him.
So if there is a takeaway as we're getting down to the end of this, it would be to ponder the list that we keep. Because the truth is, brothers and sisters, we all are both lists. There isn't anybody that doesn't have negative things about them that people could be critical of. You can't share time and space and resources without a person without having points of irritation. That is just so. But we also have another list. Most everybody has good qualities, except that guy that was dating this teenage girl. most of us have good qualities. And it really boils down to the list we choose to keep and focus on.
Yeah, well, and that's the key, and focus on and dwell on. You know, the internal self-talk becomes so important, that running conversation we always have with ourselves in our head, especially when we are emotionally upset about something. And we really need to guard our hearts and our minds about what we are telling ourselves about the other person.
And maybe that's exactly the point. When we hear ourselves mentally sort of living that list, maybe it's time to rehearse the other list. To go back and say, wait a minute, I was not dumb enough to marry such a loser. There are good qualities here. I'm choosing not to look at them. I need to go back and I need to think about that other list. Because conflict is unavoidable. That's what we see in this poem. That's part of marriage. And part of them coming back together is her refreshing her view of him.
Right.
All right. We are out of time for tonight. Next week's Bible reading, right? Going to be working in Acts?
Correct. We'll be doing Acts next week. The next section, remember, we're keeping up with our Acts reading, right? We're getting close to the end of the year. Hopefully you're keeping up with that. And so if you have questions that you want addressed in the most recent Acts reading that we've covered since the last time that we did a refresher and a Q&A night on Acts, email those in. I guess email those to me this week would be the right thing to do. You find the email address in the directory if you don't have it. But we welcome any kind of questions you want to address next week on the most recent month's Acts reading. And otherwise, we'll be discussing Acts next week. A little bit of a break from the song to do that.
And then on Halloween, the second part of the reconciliation.
Yeah, ironically, chapter 6, two weeks from tonight.
That's perfect, because my parents got married on Halloween, which is a whole story in and of itself. So that's a perfect night for us to think about this piece of marriage and this reconciliation. Let's pray together before we close. God, it's been great to be together and think about your word. We pray your wisdom will bless our relationship with our spouse. We pray that it will help our marriages bless us and bring you honor and glory. In Jesus' name, amen.